Today's topic is, could not be more timely, and we're delighted about that because we want our topics to be timely, and this one certainly is. And we have two gentlemen who are political scientists who are experts on the subject. Their biographies are in your pamphlets. You both know them by reputation. We're going to first hear from Dr. Peter Skerry, professor of political science at Boston College, giving us kind of an overview of history of immigration in American politics and life, and why different people look at it different ways. And then we're going to have Dr. John Green from the University of Akron, who many of us feel is the leading political demographer of religious voting behavior in America on almost any topic. And John is going to talk to us about the different way religious groups view immigration questions. I would give you a longer introduction, but I don't want to take up time. You know I would.
I know. Thank you, Mike. It's great to have been here, be here today. I appreciate the invitation and all the help from you and your staff to make this really a pleasant and, I think, rewarding couple of days. So,
are you in the mic? Pull it right up to your mouth.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
There you go.
Okay. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at, for a few minutes, assumptions that I see informing the views of religious leaders kind of across the board. We could talk about specific religious leaders later, if you like, about immigration. And it's not as though these religious leaders' views, I think, are so distinctive from other elites. But that is the topic on the table, so that's what I'm going to focus on. And the real thrust of my remarks is that these assumptions typically don't bear up under scrutiny, whether we're looking at immigration in the past or in the present. The three assumptions, just to lay them out quickly, are that immigrants are typically the poorest and therefore the neediest segments of the societies whence they come. We all know there are high-skilled immigrants, and that's not always true, but the discourse is always focusing on immigrants who are the poorest and the neediest. The second assumption is that very typically there are no meaningful distinctions that get drawn between immigrants and refugees, or the difference between immigrants and refugees get confounded and muddled all the time. And the third assumption that gets made by religious as well as other leaders is that that those arriving here intend to stay here and become Americans. Now, not coincidentally, these assumptions are embedded in Emma Lazarus's famous sonnet, The New Colossus, which I will now inflict upon you, just to remind us. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. We've all heard those words. They're really misleading. This sonnet and these assumptions are now entwined with the image, of course, of the Statue of Liberty, where these words are found at the main entrance of the statue. Now, we're clearly in the realm of myths and symbols at this point, which understandably suffuse the topic of immigration, which is obviously integral to our self-understanding as a nation and a people. But symbols like the Statue of Liberty are particularly powerful, but they're also changeable and protean, and that's what I want to talk about for a few minutes. After all, at its origins, as many of you may know, the statue had nothing to do with immigration. Rather, it was a gift conceived by embattled French republicans in the wake of the defeat of the Franco-Prussian War. During the 1870s, they were trying to appeal to their fellow and more successful Republicans across the Atlantic. Liberty's torch was intended not to light the way for immigrants to come into America, but to send out rays of hope to inspire Republicans around the globe to foster free and liberal institutions where they lived. But, of course, the statue's dedication in 1886 coincided with a growing influx of immigrants arriving into New York Harbor who felt themselves literally greeted by Liberty's torch. And it became part of immigrants' lore and part of our national story. Then, too, Emma Lazarus' sonnet had an important role to play in this transformation of the statue's image. It was originally written for an art exhibit that was undertaken to raise money for the statue's pedestal. But then it contributed to the confusion, the sonnet did, up to this day, between immigrants and refugees, the second of those three assumptions that I highlighted at the beginning of my remarks. All the rhetoric, what Emma Lazarus is talking about there, is a refugee story, not an immigrant story, people who were forced out of where they were coming from and came to America for refuge. I'll have more to say about that in a minute. And this is no accident. That Lazarus was moved to write about this. She was responding to the plight of her fellow Jews. She being a particularly assimilated American Jew, but she was responding to the plight of her fellow Jews fleeing pogroms in Tsarist Russia at the time. In any event, at the time of the statue's 50th anniversary in 1936. Lazarus' sonnet was displayed in a very obscure place inside the pediment on the second story beneath the statue, and the public was barely aware of it. In a ceremony at the statue in 1936, President Roosevelt did not even mention Lazarus' sonnet, though he did mention immigration, rather tangentially, and mostly to say that it was a thing of the past, as he put it. We have within our shores today the materials out of which we shall continue to build an even better home for liberty. But the story was, the door had more or less shut. It was not until a few years later, when the plight of Jews in Nazi-dominated Europe, that Lazarus's work really began to receive serious attention, undoubtedly fueled in part by our less than generous response to those in need of refuge. And in this way, the statue came to be confounded as a symbol of welcome to immigrants seeking opportunity and advancement, which was the immigrant story coming into New York Harbor, but especially at the same time to refugees fleeing danger and persecution, especially during World War II. So this brings us up to those three key assumptions underlying the understanding of immigrants, broadly construed, of our religious leaders. That first assumption, again, that those arriving here are typically the poorest of the poor. As Lazarus put it, you're tired, you're poor. But as economic historians Timothy Hatton and Jeffrey Williamson, among lots of other scholars, have pointed out, in the 19th and early 20th centuries, these were seldom the ones who migrated here, the poorest of the poor. Rather, it was those one or two strata above the poorest, those with the wherewithal to be aware of opportunities to migrate, probably those who were literate, and who had the means to plan and save for passage to the United States. Today, putting aside the obvious fact that many educated and skilled individuals seek to come here, putting those to one side, at the other end of the spectrum, it's still not the poorest of the poor who migrate here, but those of modest means, nevertheless able to save and afford the opportunity costs of not working while making the trek here, and then paying the substantial fees of a smuggler or a coyote to gain entrance into the United States. Now, maybe some fine-tuning is in order in this story. It's gotten to be the case that from Mexico, at least, coming to the United States is part of a routine, sometimes almost a rite of passage in many villages in central Mexico and in some cities. The costs and risks of the journey are hardly negligible, but they're greatly reduced such so that more and more people of lower and lower strata from Mexico are coming here. But that's a kind of fill-up on the basic story. The second assumption that gets made by our religious leaders is that immigrants are equivalent to refugees and that the circumstances that have driven and continue to drive immigrants here are not fundamentally different from those confronting refugees. Your huddled mass is yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore in the sonnet. So as I've suggested, Lazarus's powerful imagery has contributed to this confusion, but so have the needs of politicians and advocates striving to build coalitions who have minimized or ignored the differences between refugees confronted with few choices and economic migrants choosing to come here. A salient example of this occurred in 1965 when President Johnson signed that year's historic immigration reform bill, the Hart-Celler Act, which abolished the much criticized national origins quotas from the 1920s. He did so at the base of the Statue of Liberty, and unlike FDR 30 years before, cited Lazarus's sonnet, and then used the occasion, after signing the major immigration reform bill of the century, to announce a large-scale program for the reception of refugees from Castro's Cuba. There's that confusion again. It should then be no surprise, and perhaps pardonable, I would suggest, when a couple of years ago, Senator Marco Rubio claimed that his family was part of that refugee exodus out of Cuba, when in fact his parents had arrived here as ordinary immigrants in the 1950s before the revolution. Now the third assumption, the notion that immigrants and refugees alike come here intending to become Americans and make this their new home. This assumption has generally been true of refugee groups like Russian Jews, Cubans fleeing Castro, the famine Irish, perhaps in the middle of the 19th century, Vietnamese boat people. But it is not applied to many other, more strictly construed, immigrants arriving here. Indeed, at the turn of the 20th century, immigrants arriving were typically referred to as birds of passage. These were typically, at that point, Southern and some Eastern Europeans who came here intending to work hard, save money, and return home to their families. Hence, in the period leading up to World War I, the most outstanding or egregious example of this pattern were among Italian immigrants. Two-thirds of all Italian males who arrived here then subsequently returned home, reflecting in part the speed and relatively low cost of steamship travel as compared to earlier means of transatlantic voyages, but more fundamentally, for my purposes, highlighting their basic motivations to come here, work hard, save money, go home. Similarly, today, illegal immigrants, especially but not exclusively from Mexico and Central America, come here not intending to stay, but to work hard at two or more jobs, minimize their living expenses to save money, bunking in with 10, 12 other people, often young men, not always, and then returning home with enough to buy land, machinery, start a business, or build a house. Social scientists refer to these as target earners. They obviously take big risks and often get exploited by middlemen and, of course, employers. But in many respects, such individuals can be regarded as exploiting themselves. In order to reach their target earnings, they put themselves through all sorts of difficult travail and put themselves often at risk. But in so doing, they also reap substantial gains by augmenting their earning power many times over compared to what they would be earning back home. But of course, many of them, typically don't return home, at least not permanently. And most end up remaining here, settling down, having children who were born here and therefore obviously citizens, and then raising their families. Yet their original intentions don't evaporate, and their dreams of returning home linger and shape the lives, their lives and those of their children and of those around them as well. For example, in the case of undocumented Irish in New York City in the 1990s, not a group we focus on a lot, one researcher, Linda Almeida, points out how such undocumented Irish got trapped in their transience, as she put it, And she describes employers weren't always willing to invest training, time, and money in a worker if that person was likely to leave without notice or be deported as an illegal alien. It's a somewhat different view of how employers treat undocumented workers. It's a bit more ambiguous than sometimes than the simple exploitation story, I would submit. Another researcher, Mary Corcoran, reports on another aspect of the transience among undocumented Irish, on the social ties and relations in such immigrant communities. She quotes an undocumented Irish woman, here I am quoting, "You tend to not trust people here. You talk a lot of bullshit for a couple of hours, and then they want you in bed before you know it. At home, you had a lot of supports, family and friends. Here, you don't really trust anybody the same way." Alternatively, different group, different setting. Labor activists who have tried to organize undocumented immigrant workers express similar frustrations. Jennifer Gordon, an activist lawyer who unsuccessfully attempted to organize a union among Central American day laborers in Central Long Island, concludes that such populations are, as she puts it, settlers in fact, but sojourners in attitude. And as she continues, such immigrants may decide that their current wages and working conditions are good enough in the short term, which is the only term in which they imagine themselves living here. Even pithier are the comments of the organizer Bill Pastrike, a stalwart of efforts during the 1960s to organize welfare mothers, if any of you are old enough to remember that. I am, for better or for worse. And Pastrike then went on to organize labor unions, and Gordon hired him to assess her situation, her efforts among undocumented immigrants in Long Island. His advice to Gordon, quoted in Gordon's fascinating account, Suburban Sweatshops, was, and I'm quoting here, "There are just too many workers, most of whom are incredibly transient and too few jobs, and the whole scene is so fluid and uncontrollable. The employers are too small and too varied to make organizing them, the workers, practical." He concludes, "Give it up and go find an organizing campaign where you have a prayer of success." Among other things, this raises a whole lot of questions, which I won't explore now, about the wisdom or perhaps the seriousness of unions like the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, which have made a big point of their commitment to organizing undocumented workers. One final piece of evidence about how the original intentions of such immigrants not to settle here have a lingering but frequently overlooked impact. Of the 2.7 million undocumented who obtained amnesty under the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, today, a quarter century later, only 40% of that cohort have gone on to secure the U.S. citizenship for which they are eligible. Fully 60% have settled for a green card. So I can feel Mike moving. To conclude, it is such motivations, mixed and complicated and often counterintuitive motivations and outcomes that our religious leaders, as well as other elites, seem completely oblivious to. So wedded are they to the misleading rhetoric and imagery of our immigration lore, as embodied in Emma Lazarus's sonnet, and now enshrined in the Statue of Liberty. One final point in this regard about a different but related assumption relied on by the leaders of my own faith tradition, the U.S. Catholic bishops, involves their readiness to address the presumed needs of migrants to change their circumstances. And in focusing on this, the bishops have grown reliant on the biblical imagery of welcoming the stranger, the title of one of their letters to the faithful. And they express skepticism about the sanctity of national borders and assert a right to migrate. Yet it is worth noting that not all national conferences of Catholic bishops see things the same way. In Poland, for example, during the Solidarity Days in the battle against Soviet domination, the bishops there spoke out against those young Poles who took advantage of opportunities to leave their homeland and thereby deprive the movement of needed skills and leadership. So too have the Irish bishops at various times, the bishops in Ireland at various times in recent years, bemoaned and criticized the outmigration of young, educated youth to America and elsewhere. For such church leaders, liberal migration policies represent not a welcome to strangers, but a threat to the well-being of their own societies. Such alternative perspectives highlight, once again, it seems to me, how our religious leaders here in America are reliant on assumptions that need much, much closer scrutiny. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Professor Scarry. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Thank you very much. Dr. John Green is the Ray Bliss Institute professor. He's the director of the Ray Bliss Institute of Applied Politics and distinguished professor of political science, University of Akron. And many of you know John because many of you have quoted John because of John's so excellent work on voting behavior and the data therein. John is going to show us some charts about all this. Do you have handouts that we need to give to everyone, or are we just going to go with the...
We're just going to go with the overhead.
And if people want copies?
I'll be more than happy to email the PowerPoint presentation to anybody who wants it. Just let me know.
Okay. Thank you, John. You're on.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be back at the Faith Angle Conference. Michael and I were debating last night whether I'd been here four or three times. And I think the answer is three. But it seemed like four. But I've been here many times and really enjoy it. And
it's number four now.
Yeah, it's number four now. So it's really wonderful. I'd like to just look a little bit at the attitudes of different religious groups in the mass public. We'll start out by looking at some general attitudes towards immigration. Then we'll focus in on some of the policy questions. I apologize that I just realized when I got here that for people sitting in the back of the room who may have weak old eyes like mine, some of these charts may be a little bit difficult to look at, but what really counts is the patterns. And that's what I want to focus on is the patterns. But a couple of general points. You might argue that immigration and immigration reform or laws regarding immigration is sort of the original cultural conflict in the United States. We talk a lot in recent times, have talked a lot about culture wars. Well, these were, in some sense, the original culture wars. But, of course, there's an economic aspect to it. And what you'll see in some of the attitudes that we'll look at, and even in some of the questions that my colleagues at the Pew Research Center ask in these surveys, you'll see some of the assumptions that Peter was talking about. They don't just inform the attitudes of religious elites. They inform the public and even pollsters. Religion has played a very significant role in attitudes towards immigration, now in the present, in the past. It changes a lot with the circumstances, but religion has been an important factor. The key thing to know, though, is that the primary way that religion affects issues related to immigration is through religious affiliation, the groups that people belong to. Now, in just a minute, we're going to look at some fairly crude descriptions of some major religious traditions in the United States. But even these crude measures show some really interesting differences. And many of my colleagues call this the politics of belonging, that identifying and belonging to a particular group determines the attitudes that people have on these issues. So first we're going to look at these religious traditions and attitudes towards immigration in general. Then we'll turn to the immigration policy issues that we're debating in Washington right now. These data come from the Pew Research Center. The great bulk of the surveys were conducted in 2013, so this is very fresh data. This is the time where I have to issue my disclaimer. While I'm using Pew Research Center data, and I often work with them, these views are mine and mine alone, and not the responsibility of the Pew Research Center. We'll spend a little bit of time on this first picture. All the other pictures will look a lot like this. There's a standard question that's been asked for many years in various forms. It's a dichotomous question. It asks people which comes closer to their views. And the part that's in red reads, the growing number of newcomers from other countries threatens traditional American values. And the alternative is the growing number of newcomers from other countries strengthens American society. This question's been asked for 30, 40 years, and it varies a lot. The results vary a lot with the circumstances, including what's happening with immigration. Now, down the side of this chart are the religious groups that we'll look at. At the very top are white evangelicals. Below that are white Catholics. Below that are white mainline Protestants. Then the unaffiliated. We called them the nuns yesterday. They're actually better called the unaffiliated. And then some other groups. There's a group called Other Christians. Those are all the other Christians that aren't in one of the other categories. So it's a polyglot group. But the sample size is so small that we can't break out a lot of these. Then we have a category of other faiths. Those are basically non-Christians of one kind or another. Again, we don't have a big enough sample size to break out the component groups. Then black Protestants, the historic black Protestant tradition. And then all Hispanic Christians, Protestants and Catholics put together. As many of you know, there are differences between Hispanic Protestants and Catholics on many political issues. But on immigration, they look a whole lot the same. So as you can see, if you just look at the patterns of the red and blue, by the way, the gaps between the red and blue are people who didn't have an opinion, right, couldn't answer the dichotomous question. You can see a really pretty clear pattern. White evangelicals these days are the most skeptical of new people coming into our country because they, in their view, threaten American values. But you can see that white Catholics, white mainline Protestants, other white Protestant traditions, white Christian traditions, tend to have share that kind of skepticism. But as we go farther down towards the group that contains the most immigrants these days, the Hispanic Christians, that skepticism declines. But notice that even among Hispanic Christians, there's roughly a quarter that have that view of newcomers. Now, what's interesting about this question is it doesn't identify who the newcomers are, right? It's just about the idea of immigrants, the idea of new people coming into the country. But as you can see, there are also a large groups of Americans that think that newcomers strengthen American society. In fact, if you would look at this as a whole, not broken out by religious groups, a majority, 52% of Americans think that the growing number of newcomers strengthens American society. This is a view of immigration from a cultural lens. This next chart offers a little bit, looks at an economic lens. The red part of the graph is immigrants today are a burden on our society because they take jobs, housing, and health care. And that gets back to one of Peter's points that many times immigrants are seen as the neediest people who not only take jobs, but they also take social services of one kind or another. Basically the same picture, but a couple of interesting differences. You'll notice the other Christian category, which is down sort of towards the middle of the chart. Other Christians include lots of people of different status, Mormons, Orthodox Christians, black Catholics, you know, any group that wouldn't fit into one of the other categories, they're much more sensitive on the economic issue than on the cultural issue. That's also true of black Protestants. And, of course, this may have something to do with the economic circumstances of these groups. Well, just to put this in context, let's look at a contemporary culture war issue, which is support or opposition to same-sex marriage. Same religious groups, opposition or support. You can see a much, much sharper gradient if you look at the red bar from white evangelicals and move down towards the unaffiliated. Just very, very sharp change, much sharper than on immigration. But then notice when we get sort of towards the bottom of the chart, the other Christians, black Protestants, and even Hispanic Catholics have a large minority that are also opposed to same-sex marriage. So there is a difference between the cultural issues that are associated with immigration and those things that are associated with sexual conduct. So we have, different kinds of cultural conflicts, if you will. One of the really interesting things is the impact of worship attendance. Now, many of you know that it's not just the politics of belonging today. We also have the politics of believing and behaving. And this is just a very simple chart. What it does is it takes that newcomers are a threat, and it plots across these religious groups the differences in attitudes between those who are frequent attenders and less frequent attenders. The red line are frequent attenders, people who say they go to worship once a week or more, and the dashed line are less frequent attenders. And what's interesting about this picture is on this basic immigration question, it's the less frequent attenders who have the more conservative attitudes. The more frequent attenders actually have more liberal attitudes. Now, that might be the impact of religious elites talking about immigration reform, but it also may be that this isn't about religiosity. It's about group membership. And if one is threatened by members of other groups, that it's not the content of the religion, it's the group that one belongs to. And just to show how different this is what the same measure of attendance looks like for same-sex marriage. Notice that across all these religious groups, it's the frequent attenders who are the most conservative, most opposed to same-sex marriage, and it's the less frequent attenders who are less opposed. So you can see how the the cultural politics of immigration, different kind of politics than the politics of same-sex marriage or abortion. Because when we talk about those sexual issues, the new culture war issues, if you will, we're talking about the impact of believing and behaving in religious terms, not just belonging. Well, here's a really interesting diagram that's worth looking at. And this really, I think, captures the cultural milieu of the moment. This question asks, compared to the immigrants of the early 1900s, today's immigrants are less willing to adapt to the American way of life, and there are other options. We're more willing, just as willing to do that. And what I plotted here is just the answer, less willing than those immigrants from a previous era. Now, there were relatively few people in this sample that actually remember the immigration of the early 1900s, probably a few, but not very many. So this is really about symbolism. It's about, was the past better than the present when it comes to immigration? And you see this really interesting gradient across the bars, moving from white evangelicals over, I guess would be on your right, over to Hispanic Christians. White Christian communities tend to see, maybe not surprisingly, their ancestors, right, people who migrated earlier, as being more willing to fit into American society than these other groups who are characterized by more recent immigrants. So it's really kind of interesting. You can get a sense of the group impact of, the, of these religious traditions on basic attitudes towards immigration. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about contemporary immigration policy. One of the questions we asked this year at Pew was, what's the biggest problem with immigration? And we ask, is it illegal immigrants? Is it legal immigration? And as you can see with the big red lines that sort of pop out across, just about everybody thinks the big problem is illegal immigration. That's the big issue. Now, you can see with the little purple lines that there's some people that think that illegal immigration has its problems too. But overwhelmingly, that's what the debate is about. That's what the public is interested in, is the question of illegal immigration. This next chart is a kind of interesting one. What it plots is the percentage of these different religious communities that would like to see restrictions in both legal and illegal immigration. The red line is illegal immigration, and the dashed line is legal immigration. And it's interesting. Many more people would like to see illegal immigration restricted, well, probably because it's illegal. But notice that there is some sentiment at a lower level for reducing legal immigration as well. And if you look at the first part of the chart, you'll notice that the lines are almost parallel. When you look at the large white Christian traditions, they're very, very similar. But when you get over to the newer traditions, to some of these combined groups, notice that it's really legal immigration that's the problem. It really pops up. And even when we go over to the far, far side, to Hispanic Christians, there is a significant group of people that want both legal and illegal immigration restricted. And that shows that there's some diversity within these religious communities. But so I think this fits with some of the attitudes we just looked at, that there is a kind of skepticism on primarily cultural grounds but also economic grounds about immigration, whether it's illegal or legal, but of course illegal immigration being much more serious. Well, here's a counterintuitive finding. This is a question that Pew has been asking for a couple of years now. And it's a dichotomous question, and it asks, should illegal immigrants be allowed to stay in this country under certain conditions, that's the blue bars, or should illegals not be allowed to stay? Should people who were here illegally be made to leave or be deported? And I think what's counterintuitive about this is notice the size of the blue bars. Every religious tradition, every single one of these religious groups, a large majority believes that illegal immigrants should be allowed to stay under certain conditions. I'll talk about the conditions in just a second. Now, if you look at the red bars, which are much smaller, you can see the effects of those attitudes we were looking at in some of the previous slides. The white Christian tradition's more skeptical of immigration, but everybody thinks that the people who are here should be allowed to stay under particular conditions. And there's, of course, quite a debate about what those conditions would be. Now, I think this is counterintuitive, because if you just looked at those attitudes that we looked at before, you might think that the groups towards the top of the chart, right, white evangelicals, white Catholics, would actually be more in favor of deportation but they're not. This may be one of those rare instances where the public actually learned something from the debate. As you know, the mass public is not very well informed on the details of debates. But in the same survey, we asked people if they thought it was practical to deport or have illegal immigrants leave the United States. An overwhelming majority of all these religious groups has said it's simply not practical, can't be done. So people might want to do it, right? They might have those sort of sentiments. They might be skeptical about the impact these people are having in the United States, but they wouldn't be, but they think it's impractical. Now, just so before you think that the American public has now become enormously informed, the same survey showed that majorities of all these groups think that illegal immigration is growing by leaps and bounds. And as I'm sure you all know, it actually slowed down because of the recession. So, you know, the public's not completely informed, but this is one place where information actually seems to impact attitudes in a way that goes against some of the underlying values. What are some of the conditions? One condition that was very popular was that the normalization of illegal status would involve being able to speak English. Actually, all the religious groups have majorities that think that's a good idea. Much more controversial is the paying of fines. White evangelicals are actually interested in paying fines as a way for undocumented workers to stay here. Hispanic Christians think that's a terrific idea. And maybe that goes to Peter's point about the economic motivation of many immigrants in the United States. In some ways, the most controversial of these conditions in the survey was, should there be a 10-year waiting period for people to have their status normalized? White evangelicals thought that was a great idea. But as you go down the groups, down the chart, people became less and less interested in it, and Hispanic Christians are not interested in it at all. So some debate about the conditions. But the fulcrum of the debate is really something else. We asked another question, which was, well, if we had immigration reform, which of the following things comes closer to your view? We should secure the borders first, or we should secure the borders at the same time that other requirements are being implemented. And that's really, from the point of view of the mass public, that's really where the debate is now. And you can see that in this chart. If you look at white evangelicals that are at the top, a large majority thinks that the borders have to be secured first. And that reflects some of the skepticism that white evangelicals have about immigration, particularly in cultural terms, but perhaps also in economic terms. If you get down to the bottom of the chart where you see Hispanic Christians, almost the reverse, right? The larger group thinks that the larger bar is that we should secure borders, but at the same time that other things are being implemented. What's interesting to me, though, besides this big dichotomy between these two large religious groups, is if you look at white Catholics and white mainline Protestants, the second and third steps down in the chart, they're pretty evenly divided about whether it should be the border first or along with other types of changes. Now, I think this is significant if you think about the politics of immigration, because many of the representatives, both in Congress and in the lobbying community that are pushing for the border security first, come from areas where white evangelicals are very popular, but they also come very common, very populous, but they also come from areas where Hispanic population is large as well. So there's a lot of tension in this sort of thing. So in many ways, this is the fulcrum of the debate from the point of view of the politics of belonging. Now, it turns out that these things, the two groups worry about different things. Many of the people who agree with the secure the borders while we're making other arrangements are very worried about economic issues. They're worried about, on the one hand, that this normalization process will reduce jobs and use up social services. But at the same time, many of them see great benefits to the economy of normalizing the legal status of illegal immigrants. On the other hand, for people who are worried about securing the border first, they're concerned that if the borders aren't secured first, that will encourage more illegal immigration. They're also concerned that there are certain types of social dysfunction, crime, so forth, that are associated with not having secure borders. And it's interesting because if you look at this chart, you can easily imagine or easily see the popular foundation for the debate between Republicans and Democrats. But if you look deeper in the survey, there are arguments among Democrats and among Republicans about exactly how these things could be implemented. So in conclusion, I think there's a couple of interesting things to know here. One is that in the mass public, religious affiliation is a significant factor when it comes towards immigration. If you subject the kind of data we've been looking at to statistical controls, the impact of religious affiliation persists. So it suggests that the membership in these groups is important. The clear focus of the debate in the mass public is illegal immigration. Despite considerable skepticism about immigration in some religious communities, most religious groups support some mechanism to allow people who are here illegally to stay in this country. But the major division is about securing the border, which goes back to some of those images that Peter was talking about who immigrants are and what their role will be in American society. Thank you very much.
Thank you.